Coiled Spring, Episode 9. Hello, calm down, and welcome to The Coiled Spring, the podcast with potential. I'm your host, Matthew Petty, and this episode I talk to geographer, music blogger, and eldritch denizen of the outer unknown, Dr. James Neal. Also, instead of snacks, I review a couple of sodas from small independent manufacturers. They're just as sweet and delicious as the solid snacks, just in a liquid form. Perhaps I'll do gases next time. All this and more in the
Coiled Spring.
So I'm here in the office of Dr. James Neal, who is a senior lecturer in the UCL Department of Geography here in London. And he's also a very good friend of mine, and I'm very pleased to be seeing him and talking to him. Hello, James. Thanks for being on the show.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be here.
Here and now. I mean, I've had this discussion with myself about this. I have to say this episode rather than this week or this month, because that's like setting myself up to fail.
Yes.
So I'll just say today. Anyway.
Good thinking.
But so you're in the Department of Geography, but you have a particular specialty, I suppose you'd say. I mean, how would you describe that your particular realm?
Of my academic work?
Of your academic work, yes. We'll come on to the other stuff later.
Okay. I guess I usually call myself a cultural geographer or a historical geographer or both. And all that means is that I'm a human geographer, and most of what I do relates to historical stuff or literature, I guess.
Yeah.
And when I write on literature, I write about non-realist genres, which sounds very weird. It's a rather pretentious way of saying science fiction, fantasy, horror, that kind of stuff.
What they call speculative fiction.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole range of words people use, and they tend to come to blows over the
whole load of ways of avoiding calling it fantasy or anything else.
Yes. All that geeky stuff.
I mean, I'm in James's office. Dr. James's office, and I can see shelves lined with. I mean, here's a shelf lined with geography books. Above that, it's got books about William Gibson or by William Gibson and about Philip K. Dick and Mars and science fiction and. Goodness me, it's quite a stunning, array.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. It's a classic academic's office, I think. And I know that one of your particular favourites that you like to write about is H.P. Lovecraft. How did you discover H.P.?
I can't really be cool about this. I think it was role playing. I think it was actually the Call of Cthulhu role playing game.
Now, I've never really been into role-playing games, although I am kind of the type.
You are.
You have to find the right group of people, and I didn't.
I imagine being raised by wolves made it hard to find that kind of circle. Difficult to pick up a D4.
Someone who says that they were raised by wolf spiders, which is how he managed to learn to pull things out of his arse. Hello, Matt, if you're listening. H.P. Lovecraft. Yeah, so the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, I mean, how does that work? You have a team of people investigating some
house? Basically it's just a way of making yourself feel really futile because, you know, no one ever comes out of these things very well except Cthulhu.
Either dead or insane, perhaps?
Yeah, there's lots of going mad. I mean, later games like Alone in the Dark would do that to you, but
yes.
And of course Doom and Quake and all those sorts of
things. Alone in the Dark, the adventure thing.
But before there were computer games like that, it was role-playing. And I think it is credited with reviving interest in, well, not reviving interest in Lovecraft, but giving a new generation a reason to read him.
Okay.
Because there was a sort of boom in the 60s and 70s, and then that had kind of faded away before the early 80s.
So in the 60s and 70s, where do you think that came from? If it wasn't,
it's partly part of this sort of broader countercultural interest in anything that wasn't normal.
Yeah,
anything white bread and straightforward. So,
I mean, because Tolkien got a boost in that time as well.
Yeah, I mean, Lovecraft was not going to fit as well with the hippie mentality as Tolkien was, but I think a lot of the same people started to get interested in something magical.
And the acid went bad as well,
yeah,
I suppose.
That's right. So when he's and there are bits of Lovecraft that are quite pastoral and not frightening, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some quite interesting
stuff. Can you think of any examples?
Well, the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath.
That's true.
Is his fantasy.
It's just like a fantasy tour, isn't it?
It's a travelogue, but with sort of shapeless goblins in it.
And lots of cats.
Yes. Yeah, he was obsessed with cats.
I mean, was that part of the Egyptian side of things, perhaps?
I think he liked cats anyway, and he also liked ancient Egypt, and that just happened to be a kind of crossover.
Yeah.
But yeah, he often said he, you know, he'd had some very good friends who were cats, effectively. he did make friends easily, but he also did like cats.
Especially purebred cats.
Well, yeah, you can imagine what his black cat was called. I'm not going to say it on this podcast.
Well, there was a cat by that name in The Rats in the Walls, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I think that was probably his cat starring in a
N-word man.
Yeah, he was a deeply racist man, which is why it is a bit awkward liking.
But literally racist in a kind of original way. I don't mean original as in unusual. I mean original as in actually racist. Like, this race is better than that race, as opposed to just being a bigot.
Yeah.
He was. I'm not defending it, by the way.
He was probably pretty bigoted, too. But yeah,
yes,
he drew on ideas of racial science that were a bit outdated by the time he liked them. I mean, they were kind of late 19th century ideas for anthropology and elsewhere. I mean, he was pretty fond of his British roots, and I think he picked up a lot of these ideas from kind of imperial ideas about who were the best, basically. And he had a very strict hierarchy. And, yeah, I mean, the stuff he wrote about living in New York is really, really unpleasant. It's kind of... He was faintly frothing, I think, when he lived there, because he thought it was just full of, you know, these weird interbreeding monsters.
Yes.
There is an argument. People like China Mayville say that that's what drives his horror, that all of his horror is a response to, you know,
the other
city like New York and the prospect of places like Providence becoming like that and so on.
Wow. Interesting.
As if Providence had always been inhabited by English-speaking people from the beginning of time.
Well, that's the classic. That's the classic conservative outlook, isn't it? I read something recently that really quite nicely summed up the difference between conservatives and progressives. And the conservative outlook is that there was a time when it was good, and we just need to get back to that.
Mm.
Whereas the progressive outlook is that it's never been good, and we have to move forward to get to something that is good.
Yeah. I did say it might be noisy.
That's okay. There's a bit of building work going on there.
There's always building work going on. Nothing grows there. If you look out the window, it's a sort of derelict, ruined landscape. Well, there's a couple of trees.
Is that why there's this guy here playing the cello wildly out of the window?
You actually made me look there. A cello is not quite as mobile as a violin, is it? That would be a slightly more awkward, demonic instrument to have to carry around.
Or a thin.
If that doesn't Eric Zan play out the window, that might be quite hard to do with a cello.
You'd have big speakers, wouldn't it, these days?
The tuba or Eric Zan.
Could you possibly say that the song, the Rod Stewart song, I can't remember the title of the song, but it's about putting the speakers in the window and playing Motown records out of the window. Could that be a response to Lovecraft's Eric Zan?
It's an interesting thesis, and I'll have to look into it.
Perhaps your next paper could.
I think it's unlikely. I mean, you can imagine that Lovecraft would have seen Motown as some sort of, you know, terrible music. I'm not sure he would have liked it at all. So you can imagine Lovecraft going with that. But I don't know whether he would have seen Rod Stewart as enough of a sort of shaman from a debased culture.
Yeah. Do you think I'm?
There's a joke there, but I'm not going to make it at all.
No, this is podcast verite.
No,
sorry.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
So how does your academic work tie into to Lovecraft and the other literary people that you are interested in?
That's a really good question. I should have an answer to it, really. But
Well, sum up your entire career for us. I mean, come on.
Well, it should be easy, shouldn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, seriously, I should be able to tell people what I do.
I can't, don't worry about it.
I do I mean, obviously, there's quite a lot of people who write about Lovecraft, and there's lots of people who write about all the other authors I'm interested in, science mm-hmm. fiction, horror and stuff.
Yeah.
And what I do that's different is that I'm a geographer, so what I'm really interested in, I suppose, is the way in which all these people think about space and place.
Okay.
And Lovecraft, the easy way of explaining that, I suppose, is that he was always writing, not always, usually writing about either an invasion from somewhere else or something that bubbles up from inside because it's been repressed and is the result of some kind of past sin or past pollution or transgression. So there's usually a kind of a transgression, all these rather cheesy words.
So when you say transgression, I suppose the literal meaning of that is like crossing lines, crossing borders. Because transgression can also mean like kind of taboos and stuff.
Yeah. And people tend to roll those together when they're writing about this kind of horror. So you get literally sort of invasions from beyond.
From beyond.
There are things on thresholds, on doorsteps. Yes. There are, you know, it's constantly a language of there being somewhere else and these things kind of, you know, waiting to,
the
walls to break down the wall of sleep.
Beyond the wall of sleep.
What else is there?
Break on through to the other
side.
And
there's also contact from the past.
Yes.
From the future,
well, that's more like a sort of something that happened maybe in your family.
Mm.
There's a couple of stories that
there's
are like
family curses,
family curses,
kind of
sins of the father.
Yeah. But some of those things,
yes, yeah, very Poe. Yeah,
yeah, and some of those things then become stretched out. So there are stories where people's minds are sort of taken over by alien intelligences
that
are from
again.
Either the future or from the past, effectively. They're time-travelling minds. Invasion of places, people's bodies, people's minds. I mean, that is one of the main themes of horror anyway. Arguably, all I've done is say this is Lovecraft's version of it.
Yeah.
You know, vampires invade the body, they puncture the skin of the body.
True.
Dracula lands on Whitby Beach. He kind of
invasion.
Throws himself onto the beach and escapes in the form of a giant hound, if I remember right.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
I've never actually read Dracula, of course.
Yeah, well, I've just spoiled the best bit for you then.
Well,
I think that's...
What else happens? So this Dracula guy, I mean...
Turns out he's not as good as he seems. It is also the only, I think, only novel I've read anyway where the hero is an estate agent.
There's a very good reason for that.
Plus, he's not in it very much.
That's true.
For a hero.
He does get locked up and eaten, which is the best fate you can hope for an estate agent.
I can't remember whether he makes it out alive. God, I shouldn't. I'm not really a Dracula expert, I should say.
No. And I'm not a fan of estate agents, but, you know.
Yes, you can say he had a... No. I'm not going to go for that terrible pun.
What's that?
Go on. He had a stake in some property developing in London.
Yeah, don't worry. I will cut that bit out. Oh dear. So transgressions and crossing the borders and all that kind of thing. And I think a lot of, I mean, obviously Lovecraft has a great following now these days, and it's not necessarily it's kind of shorthand as well for a kind of anything to do with that kind of cosmic horror and weird stuff from beyond and one way, and that's been manifested in recent years, is Zalgo.
Yes.
Have you heard of Zalgo?
Yes, I think you. You
I think I pointed
you
on to Zalgo. Being now, I don't know exactly how it came about. I think it was on the Something Awful forums, and I think 4chan might have picked it up, and Penny Arcade. Some web comic might have done it as well, but it basically is, yeah, he comes, he waits, he will, his one of his six mouths will sing the song that ends the earth, and but that general idea of just
I think he
weirdness,
is
shorthand
very,
for weirdness.
It is very Lovecraftian. I mean, the thing is, I think it is starting to get to the point now where everything seems a bit Lovecraftian, and in a way it's quite easy to for people to get sort of, I don't know, slightly confused as to whether he coined this or whether he was just one of the people who did this in a very successful way. Because there is an argument as well that he, I mean, not only has the internet become suffused with Lovecraft, but it's also changed Lovecraft. Like, a lot of what's said about Lovecraft isn't the racist stuff. So we've totally changed that, I think. You know, people have, on the whole, stuck with the monster, stuck with the kind of cosmic fear, the sense of mankind's tiny kingdom of knowledge in this sea of horrible, frightening ignorance, but they've lost the racist overtones of that.
Yeah, and it'd be just because, I suppose, they want to hang on to the cool stuff without having to concern themselves.
I mean, there are racist Lovecraft fans, unfortunately, and you know, it doesn't take is much there, on the internet to find them. But
is there a kind of a Lovecraft thread on Stormfront?
I don't know.
.org?
All I know is that Stormfront in the UK is a fairly respectable Apple reseller. If you Google Stormfront, the top thing, even in the UK on Google, then, is the whatever they are. Dodgy site that I don't want to click
on.
Yeah,
they're just white supremacist kind of.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the stomach for researching those sorts of people.
No.
But all I know is that quite often I'll be reading something interesting on a blog, and then I'll get to the bit where I think, oh God, no. And I've learned some interesting things, but you know, I'm not going to cite those things, which might be seen as censorship. But it's more that I can find somewhere which says the same thing, and I don't need to give these people the, you know, publicity.
Yes. Oh, I see. So when you're researching your work, sometimes you...
Yeah. Well, you know, like everyone else, I read blogs, academics blog, and non-academics who are experts. There's lots of Lovecraft scholars out there who are not academics, and some of them are dodgy in the way that I think a kind of right-wing libertarianism, you know, encourages that sort of frothing... I'd say this about anyone, but I like to concentrate on gays and, you know, Jews and everyone else. And then there are people who are a bit more thoroughgoing kind of nutters.
Really. Straightforward.
Yeah.
Straight down the line nutters.
Yeah, and you get this weird thing where people will say, you know, we mustn't just focus on Lovecraft for his racism, because it was a very common thing at the time, which is true.
Yes.
And there are other authors who wrote about similar sorts of things but are lauded, like Henry James, who, you know, was some quite anti-Semitic stuff in some of his correspondence, I think. And you read this and you think, oh, that's really interesting. And then you think, ah, this bit where they say, and that proves it's okay to write anti-Semitic stuff in horror stories. That's the moment where you think, no, I don't really want to read any more of this.
Yeah, that's a shame.
But you still learn something. You just go back to, you know, a more reputable source for it. Anyway, right. Then how we got
into this? Well, no, that's good. It's because people draw different conclusions. And so, you know, some people draw the conclusion that some races are better than others.
Unfortunately.
Some races are better than
the idea. If you take him seriously, although how you can take Lovecraft seriously for some things, not others, I don't really understand. You know, either Nyarlathotep is coming to get us.
That reminds me, I mean, of talk about invasions and things from the other, and Mars. I keep seeing the word Mars on your bookshelf. A few years ago there was a Mars film, Mission to Mars or The Red Planet, one of the two. There was a couple that came out at the same time. This is the one with Tim Robbins and Gary Sinise or whatever his name is. They find it's the face on Mars, and it turns out to be actual face. And they set a spaceship, goes there, they land, and something happens. And so there's all this kind of crazy, impossible stuff happening. And then they go into, it turns out to be a building, and they go into the building, and they do some sensor tricorder stuff, and there's air inside the building. And one of the scientist astronauts says, that's impossible. And it's like, you're inside a face on Mars. Shouldn't you be just sort of not
not caring.
Not caring point. About whether it's, well, it's true. You shouldn't, yeah.
When yeah.
I don't know.
I didn't see that film. It does sound terrible.
It's slow.
Right.
And it's a bit kind of Armageddon, group of heroes going off together, who's going to come back. And it's like, so it's a character piece.
Right.
Yeah, it's not very good. I don't like the colour palette either.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
Something different for the snack review this time. I'm not going to review a cake or a biscuit or anything like that. I'm going to review a soda, a fizzy pop. And this one is called Cheer Wine. Well, maybe I should give you a bit of background. In America, and I'm sure elsewhere in the world, certainly in the UK I know, there are lots of small independent soda companies. Obviously having trouble competing with the huge behemoths of Coca-Cola and Pepsi and all those guys, but they still march on and they soldier on. And small independent retailers such as The Fizzery on Mission Street in San Francisco, run by some friends of mine, and also places in Los Angeles and other places across the country, remain, and they sell these sodas. The Fizzery in particular has, I think, 900 different varieties. And cheer wine is one that is apparently has a lot of nostalgic appeal for a lot of people because they remember it from their childhood and they thought it had disappeared, but then they come into the Fizzery and there it is waiting for them. So I'm going to taste it for you now. The bottle, first I should describe, the bottle actually looks a little bit like a Coca-Cola bottle, except with straight sides. I don't know whether that's just because that's how soda bottles have always been made. And it's got the little cheer wine logo on there, bottling company since 1917. So it's obviously been around a long time. And it's a twist-off cap, so let's have a go. Now, what is cheer wine? Well, I can tell straight away, it's cherry. It's cherry soda. And let's have a taste. Oh, yes. Now, it's not too sweet. It's got a lovely soda cherry flavour. I mean, that is to say, you know, the cherry flavour that you don't associate with cherries, but you associate with cherry-flavoured stuff. But it's not too overpowering, it's not too sweet. Yeah, it's really good, actually. It's got a bit of dryness to it. If Taylor, the proprietor of the Fizzery, were here, he'd be able to go into lots more detail about mouthfeel and flavour profile and all that kind of stuff. But I'm just going to have to stick with the basics. It's cold, it's fizzy, it's a deep, dark red colour. I'll hold it up to the light. And it's got this great, sweet, but not too sweet, cherry flavour. And let's look at the ingredients. That's I think the whole point of this, these sodas, is that they are very, simple things. And there's no high fructose corn syrup, for example. It's cane sugar, real cane sugar, artificial wild cherry and other natural flavours, and that's it. Obviously, carbonated water is the main ingredient. But yeah, there we go. So, unique sparkling soft drink. Drink Cheer Wine, bottling company since 1917. It's a delicious cherry soda. Check it out, and there'll be more of these to come.
Yes. So the internet has done lots of things with Lovecraft, including, yes, you know, people have been quite inventive. On the whole, though, I think they've tended to lose the stuff which seems very early 20th century to them, the racist stuff.
Yes.
But what's also interesting about Lovecraft is that it's also not just him writing this stuff, that he was such a keen fan of writing to his friends and a fan of other people's work.
Right.
That those ideas are all really mashed up. It's difficult
to know
whose is what.
Yes, yeah, and I don't think I've read much of the stuff, you know, of the other Cthulhu mythos stuff. Mm. I mean, who else was that? Robert Bloch?
Yeah, Robert Bloch. Clark Ashton Smith is very good, and a Californian writer as well.
Oh, there you go.
And very entertaining. And a big influence on Fritz Lieber in his writing style, so he's got that slightly decadent, funny...
Okay.
So it's a very, dare I say it, a very European sensibility.
Despite being in California.
Yeah, but it's a kind of American take on, I don't know, decadent writing, I suppose. But it is very entertaining and blackly humorous all the way through. And a big influence on people like Moorcock, I think. So it's slightly, there's a bit of sort of fever dream, over-the-top imagery. It's all lurid technicolour, but not pulpy. It's a funny mix.
Interesting.
And Derleth did his best, I suppose. He tends to get rubbish now as being the kind of plodder.
Oh.
But, you know, all these people, in writing to Lovecraft and to each other, they mixed up these ideas and they, in a sense, they're not just Lovecraft's, in the same way that his ideas are no longer his because lots of people on the internet have been rewriting them for so long. So Zalgo, in a way, is just another... sort of Lovecraftian.
Well, it's just another intrusion into our dimension of the nameless
indeed.
Horror.
Indeed. Was that the one that's based on a capture thing? What's the one that was based on a capture code?
Oh, I can't.
The name itself comes from a...
Possibly. I know that, there was one about...
Which is a fantastic idea.
The idea that the captures are commands.
Yeah.
People see the capture words...
There were two words for something
kill
like...
Kill mother. It's like, I obey.
Like summon Zalgo.
Summon Zalgo, possibly, yeah. I'll have to... exercise for the listener. figure out where Zalgo came from.
2 seconds of Google searching.
Yeah, well, probably, yeah. Sites. It's like my last episode with Robin. We were trying to remember who... I can't even remember what we were talking about then. Exercise for the listener. Remind me what Robin and I talked about last time.
Are they the Spitfires?
Are they Spitfires? No. Or are they the Apache gunships? Okay, so let's get on to our next subject, which is... Walking into this university building, I saw several pieces of graffiti and stickers along the lines of fuck Thatcher, really? Fuck the Tories, the witch is dead, ding dong. And also scrubbed off the wall was fight the bosses, not their wars.
Yeah, that's quite an old one. I haven't seen the other ones because I've not been into work for a while. Taxpayer.
Well, it was all on one.
Not Taxpayers Alliance. I haven't been in for ages.
Sabbatical? You should be pumping out
generating
the papers.
Generating research ideas.
Oh, right, yes. There you go.
Yes, graffiti. That one's quite an old one. The Fight the Bosses, Not the Wars.
Yeah, I like that one.
It's SOAS is just around the corner, the School of Oriental and Asian Studies.
Okay.
No, Oriental and African Studies. It couldn't be Oriental and Asian. That would be peculiar, wouldn't it? And it's called that because it was at one point a sort of imperial... science to study those parts of the world.
Inscrutable.
Yes, that's right, we needed to work out. And it used to be next door to the School of Slavonic and East European Studies, which in the post-war period was heavily funded by the British and American governments to send academics to...
Russia.
Russia and Eastern Europe. In fact, some of the academics who taught me were at least in touch with... security agencies in this country, and there's a really interesting research project going on, people at the University of Birmingham to do some oral histories of basically academics who might or might not have been spying for Britain.
Fascinating.
Anyway, so that was the bit where we spied on people down there, but now, clearly, their university departments are schools, colleges, really, and SOAS in particular is very radical. It's the most politically radical, probably, of all of the colleges in the University of London, and that's why this whole area... It can be quite lively.
Yes.
And it's also where, when there's a big demonstration or the students are meeting nationally, the national meeting point for the start of the demonstration is on Mallet Street, round the corner.
Okay.
So this tends to be the kind of epicentre of all shouty student stuff.
Shouty student stuff. And will there be shouty student stuff tomorrow, Wednesday, for the funeral of the late Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher?
I don't know. It's interesting. I'd be surprised if nothing happened.
Mm.
But on the other hand, I think what happened in Boston might take some of the fun out of it.
Yes, of course, the terrorist bombings at the marathon on Patriots Day in Boston.
It's also, I think in a way, it's interesting that the management of her funeral, which would have you thought would be such a gift for a Conservative government, which is pretty much running the country, even if it apparently needs a few Lib Dems to do it.
Yeah.
You think it was in their, in their favour. They couldn't possibly do it wrongly. But they have made such a bosh of it, I think. How have they made a bosh of it? Well, if there'd been a sort of blanket agreement that we all had to stifle criticism and just get on with it, and, she was just sort of an old woman and... What harm did she do anybody and all that kind of stuff?
All that stuff, which is a common theme, yes.
Yes, and I don't think... I think some people would have felt that they would have had to have protested at the funeral itself. That would have had to have been the sort of last chance that you could have had that conversation and opened things up again. But things have opened up so drastically across the country in a way which I think I'm quite relieved about, really, because I was thinking this would just be this terrible kind of, series of eulogies. I mean, people tell me when Reagan died, no one said a bad word about him.
Well, that's what I mean. There was a lot of stuff about let's not let Reaganization.
Yeah.
I mean, they talk about canonization.
Yeah.
But there was this Reaganization, and let's quickly name every airport and street and everything after him, and never say a bad word against him again. Mm. But is that part of? I mean, when did Reagan die?
I can't remember. I was thinking this the other day because the only thing I can think of that's a fairly public criticism, although they weren't exactly megastars at the time, was the Coen brothers' film Raising Arizona, where at one point Nick Cage's voiceover yes. talks about how hard it is with that some bitch Reagan in the White House.
Yes, that's right.
And it's a blue collar. Yeah, that's why he turns back to crime.
Back to crime.
Finds himself driving past convenience stores that aren't even on his way home.
That's right. That's right. And that's all in the opening monologue, isn't it? Yeah,
superb film, one of my favourite films. Fantastic. But that's the only thing I can think of, and that's sort of late '80s, isn't it?
So, the point I was going to make was, there's a lot more open discussion about everything, and any possible point of view you want is available to you. And so, and so the national media or the media industry doesn't necessarily control the conversation anymore.
No, and it's so divisive that even the most popular papers, which should be keen on Thatcher and should be keen on preserving her legacy, even they have been, because they've been trying to score points by pointing out division, they have basically just been devoting their front pages to how divided we are as a nation, which is effectively, I think, a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Because it means that there is still a conversation to be had.
Yeah.
And the Scots, did you see, I don't know whether you've had a chance to have a look at the papers, but the Scottish Parliament was going to have a debate about her legacy a couple of hours after she had been buried.
Ooh.
And they've now moved it under threat from Scottish Tories. I didn't think there were any left.
Are there Scottish Tories?
I thought there were more grouse than
Tories. Talk about from beyond.
Yeah. Well, that's right, they've probably come out of the water at full moon. With the Innsmouth look. I think senior landowning Tories do have the Innsmouth look, although they're probably more worms of the earth. He wrote about subterranean degenerate humans who had once ruled the earth.
Okay.
Like the Tories had ruled Scotland.
So the Tories are the worms of the earth as written by...
Yeah, although it gets a bit more complicated.
So as Robert Howard wrote about in So the Worms of the Earth.
I think let's just cut out that whole bit about subterranean Tories.
Come on, I like the coming out of the Clyde at midnight.
Yes. Anyway, so yeah, the Scots have obviously been very keen to keep that conversation rolling. But
And there was some of the first stuff I saw was Glenda Jackson's fantastic.
Mm. Oh, yeah, God bless her.
8 minute. I wouldn't call it a tirade. She was very level throughout, but she just kept talking about it, and it was great. And you could hear people on the other side of the house going, "I can't take it." And then someone is it a point of order? And of course, the speaker, who seems to be quite a chap.
Yeah, no, he's. I think when he got the job, everyone said marvellous. You know, he's got his own. He's his own man, and now they're thinking, "Damn, he's a man who likes to do what he wants."
Yeah,
I think that's the point that so many people have been saying: is this the right way to do it? Like, there's now some senior Tories not going to go to the funeral because it's divisive the way that the Queen has had to come along, or something to do with the armed forces. So there are some senior Tories who aren't keen on the way it's all been sort of stage managed.
For what? I'm not sure.
I think it's something to do with the way it makes the Queen look like she's keen on this, and that all the armed forces are going to be present at the funeral. So it looks like there's this sort of complete groundswell of support for.
Well, that's what they're trying to.
Peacetime Prime Minister.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're trying to push. I think.
But I think he's saying.
Well, because I saw a thing on the news last night talking about they had Diane Abbott, the MP from wherever. And some Tory, they all look the same to me. Wait, a guy wearing a blue tie.
Is he glistening?
No, it was Jenkins. It was Jenkins Jr. And he just, but they had a report about the funeral arrangements and how all the pallbearers are, or at least most of them are Falklands veterans. And they keep focusing on the Falklands, which is funny because if you were taking the negative view, it's the Falklands that got her elected again in 83 anyway. So it's like, yes, she won this war, but also she only got elected because of the war. Yeah. It's like,
pretty
loathsome.
Yeah, it was a totally self-serving war in that respect. Mm. Although people in Argentina seemed keen.
They were keen on it.
I think the way the funeral is kind of constantly attracting fresh criticism is amazing, really. So in a sense, maybe people won't feel that they have to do so much.
Mm.
You know, the party that happened on Saturday, which I kind of was going to go to, but didn't. One that had been arranged since she stepped down, pretty much. Well, it'd be in Trafalgar Square first Saturday after she
Class dies. War, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, although I think, I don't really know, but I think a number of other people had come up with it just as a sort of standby, because, you know, you never know when these things are going to happen, so you need to have a sort of...
That's a good idea.
...provisional arrangement if you're going to celebrate these things. But there were very few arrests, and it didn't turn into anything other than a bit of a kneeser.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
But then, of course, Wednesday, tomorrow, is the funeral itself, procession, gun carriage, coffin, and I think people are talking about, if they happen, not necessarily going deliberately to be there, but turning their backs.
It is a, yeah, I mean, that's where you have to make a conscious decision to snub it. So you have to turn up and then you have to turn your back. But on Wednesday morning...
Tempted to look over your shoulder. No, no, no
well,
looking.
Until you know she's in the ground, would you turn your back on her? Of course, you couldn't use a mirror to see whether she was behind you either. You know, horror metaphors are very very profound in this time.
Well, they... Coming back to Lovecraft, that's because it's, you know, the further we get out into space, the more we know that there is out there.
Indeed. So you're saying she's a space vampire. Didn't we come in at this point?
Space Vampires, that was a good film.
I don't know that one.
You don't know that one?
I don't think so.
It's awful. Well, it's kind of interesting in a terrible way. Anyway.
Surprisingly.
It was filmed as Life Force.
Oh, Tobe Hooper's Life Force.
And written by Colin Wilson.
Really? Jesus.
Yes, anyway.
I think I might have seen it. I might have rented it from when our local garage did videos. That was always the place you went if you'd watched all the other videos in the town.
Yes, into the garage. And they had
I might have seen that there.
Some choice ones, if you wanted some...
Oh, they didn't have anything under the counter, if that's what you're suggesting.
Oh, well, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the sort of the Italian Mad Max rip-offs.
Now, those are probably about to be remade by Tarantino or someone.
Yes, he'll be moving on to that next, the post-apocalyptic.
Yeah. I'm surprised he hasn't done it already. Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't think I'll be going... I did think about it, but I don't think I'm going just because I've got stuff to do. I think I'm, you know...
See, that's disappointing.
You're tempted to go, are you?
Well, I'm kind of in the city anyway. No, I am a tourist, yes. What's happening in London at the moment?
Yeah,
imagine
the photos.
Yeah.
I think, though, I mean, if they were going to shoot her out of the gun that she's been transported on, I would definitely go. Isn't that the deal?
At Big Ben.
Yeah. That's why they've taken the bell out, in case it...
Well, yes, because we were talking about this before we were recording, about what... So Big Ben, and it is Big Ben, because Big Ben is the bell.
Yes.
Big Ben won't be ringing for the period of the funeral, and people are saying, "Oof, why does she get?"
It was only stopped before when Churchill was buried, I think, but also when Zeppelins were bombing London, and they were thought to be using it as a, you know, oral signal.
Blimey!
Although, surely, of the noise of those engines, I've seen Rocketeer or whatever it is. I'm sure they're pretty noisy Zeppelins, aren't they?
Well, they're not rocket powered.
No, doesn't he attack a Zeppelin at one point? God.
Oh, well, it's got like...
I do actually get paid for knowing some of this, but I don't know any of these things I'm talking about. But I think, surely, does that mean we're about to be attacked at the moment of her death? Maybe that's
right.
And
that's what you were saying, is that there was going to be an EMP, an electromagnetic
pulse.
Well,
it's not going to knock out an ancient cast iron bell, is it? That's where that idea breaks down. But it does make sense, if we're about to be attacked by something, that London will go silent, including the bell, while something searches for us blindly in the abyss. Finding nothing there will move on and devour Paris or something.
Yeah.
It's probably deliberate.
Some sort of rift might open.
I think it's one of the renders of the veil, one of the devourers of human souls.
I see.
I suspect. She's been waiting for her to die.
You've been reading Hellboy again, haven't you? See, Hellboy, that's another thing.
Yeah.
I mean, all the whole supernatural... Yeah, anyway. And there was a possibility as well, we were talking, because she's the Iron Lady...
Yes.
...was, she's powered by a chest-mounted miniature fusion reactor.
Like Iron Man.
Like Iron Man. And when she's burned or buried or whatever they do, put her through a mangler or something, that will implode and cause some sort of singularity, perhaps?
I mean, that's why I thought they should shoot her out of something, get her out of Earth's orbit. Into the sun.
Into the sun. But then the sun would go black.
Yeah.
and then the doors would open.
Maybe it would just make the sun a bit warmer for a bit. I mean, you know, there's quite a lot of fusion power going on in the sun.
Possibly, but couldn't it disrupt the sun enough to cause some kind of conjunction, and then the time is right, and
then you have that film,
the doors open,
Sunshine, where you have to go to start the sun up again by putting Margaret Thatcher's body into it. That's the version that they didn't green light, I heard.
Oh, Danny. Was it Danny Boyle?
It was, yeah. I quite like that film.
I've not seen it.
It's really gritty, and the heroes are all engineers and people who fix things. You'll like it. It's good. It's kind of quite BBC Two. It's really sort of straightforward, you know. It's like Space 1999 about saving the sun. It's very sort of... There's people have meetings and...
Interesting.
There's a little bit of madness and a bit of kind of cosmic stuff, but it's quite good. And if you watch it on a big TV, actually get a little bit of sunburn from it. So there's a lot of bright kind of, oh my God, I can barely look.
Well, I mean, so did you see Prometheus?
No, I haven't yet, because I can only take so much disappointment, and I need to be in a really good mood.
I'm sorry.
Don't tell me that. No one said it's good.
What annoyed me about it, and what annoyed me about some people's readings of it, that's so pretentious, is that, well, the fact that they had a reading of it, when, in fact, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And you can't say about it that, oh no, it's just because it's deep and thoughtful and you have to think about it and
come
away.
People have been saying that about Blade Runner for ages, but, you know, similarly, maybe it's just a bit of an incoherent mess.
Possibly.
People have later gone, well, possibly.
I have to, but you are speaking to someone who does like the voiceover version.
Yeah.
Because of its straightforward film noir.
Yeah, I do.
It's because it's the first
one. And the Vangelis theme and all the rest of it. Yeah, there's lots of stuff in the film which isn't actually anything to do with Ridley Scott.
Yes, that's right. If you take out all the Ridley Scott bits.
So similarly, in Prometheus, must be some bits that are...
Well, so one of the things, this won't be spoiling it for you, but the idea that it's this sort of expedition across the galaxy or whatever, and none of the people on board have met each other or like each other, this doesn't make any sense. Oh well, yes. Well, watch it, and I'll
will
be
when
very...
it gets down to about £4 in FOP or Sainsbury's, then I'll buy it, because I'm not paying full price for something that I know will be disappointing. Although I managed to find a copy of Lake Placid on my old hard drive.
You did tell me about
genius.
This. What, is that the
giant crocodile? What a cast. Betty from The Golden Girls.
As in Bessie White?
Yeah.
Oh, she's like owns a cabin on the lake shore or something,
yeah,
does she? And
yeah,
feeds it cows?
You'll have to cut the whole thing out because...
Well, because I've spoiled the plot of Lake Placid.
Yeah. It's a great film.
I'm sure it is.
It's a great
film. I actually watched Troll Hunter recently.
Oh, did you like it?
I loved it. And
I was going to say, get out!
No, Fantastic film. In fact, I went to the Wikipedia page describing trolls, and they talk about the fact that there are various types of trolls.
Yeah.
And I edited the Wikipedia page to say that this particular type of troll was mentioned by name in the how would you call it, the horror comedy shaky cam.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Monster... Yeah. It's difficult to know what it is, really.
It's very good, though.
But it is very good.
Great colour palette.
Yeah. It's just got the right touch. I think it's not taking itself too seriously, but it's not playing it purely for laughs either.
Absolutely, yeah.
Watching Siobhan's face when the second troll appears, you get a full kind of view of the first troll. It's hilarious. She was quite scared. She was kind of goggling in alarm at this thing. So it works. It works well, I think.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
I would like to...
apologise.
No.
For this terrible rambling conversation.
Well, that's part of the charm of The Coiled Spring. And part of the charm of my conversations with you, James. I'm very glad that I came all the way over here to talk to you. But what I would like to also talk to you about...
Yes.
..is your side project, apart from all your academic work, of the music blog, Both Bars On.
Mm.
I'd like to talk about that. So, I mean... That's not just you, is it? That's
my very good friend and colleague, mm-hmm, Julian Holloway, or Bon Holloway in Manchester, who runs the northern desk. I operate the southern office,
mm-hmm,
And between us, we have been doing this for, amazingly, 7 years. 6 years.
Six years. Wow.
6 years recently, because we started it properly on his birthday.
Okay.
And every year I forget that, and every year he reminds me that it's his birthday and the blog's birthday.
So you forget his birthday and the blog's
birthday.
Which
is weird, because I met my wife because of his birthday.
There you go.
So I should remember the whole thing, really, shouldn't I? But anyway.
You should remember to post once in a while as well.
Yeah, well.
No, I'm...
He'll like that.
I mean, you have different... I mean, you talk about the northern and the southern desks. Do you have different tastes? Obviously, your tastes sort of overlap enough to have a blog together.
There's a bit of a mixture. I mean, I've met one fan, if we can call him that, of both Barzon, who... thought it was hilarious when the two of us met up, because no sooner had we started talking about music than we started disagreeing about music, and he said, oh, it's just like reading the blog.
Right.
So often we don't agree entirely. We have different musical tastes. I mean, he loves jazz. He loves jazz. He's always going on about jazz.
I mean, I suppose the free-form nature of it, and also the expertise of the musicians and the way that they can take a seed.
He is a real fan of high production values and... Craft
and talent, right?
Yeah.
Musical talent, skill,
virtuosity.
Yeah, I can.
And that comes out of his own musical career, of course. He is a talented musician in his own right, and he's in a band. I think there's a band. He and a few other people in Manchester are going to be unleashing on the world.
Well, I have actually listened to a track that they put on SoundCloud, I think it was, and the name of the band?
That would be Flange Circus.
Flange Circus, which puts me in mind of Beaver Patrol for some reason.
You think so? Well, he's,
It's like, how was the club last night? It was a bit of a Flange Circus.
I don't know if that's the sort of meaning that they were going for.
I had a very
sensible and restrained upbringing, so I don't really understand what those words mean.
Of course. Or perhaps it's a kind of... There was also an electronic music artist of those of the 90, early 90s called Midi Rain.
Right.
So it's like... So taking a musical production thing...
Mm.
And says so you've got Flange Circus, you've got Midi Rain, you've got
I think there
Overdrive
will be,
truck.
It's a double entendre, I suspect.
I suppose. Or maybe it's just about Flange.
What, flam? Like quiche. I don't know. Anyway, I mean, they're not officially affiliated with both Barzon, but we wish them well.
Of course.
It would be a bit awkward if we have to review them, because it would be me reviewing it.
It would be. That's an interesting point, because, of course... If it's the kind of thing that Bon likes, that he is making, he would normally be the one to review it.
Indeed.
But you'll have to review it.
Indeed.
Whereas you're
Unless
more of
he
a...
he could write it and I'll just put my name on it. I mean, we have very high professional standards.
You have very high standards of music. I mean, in fact, it could be said that my musical tastes have calcified over the years.
Okay.
But I will say this, both Barzon has opened my ears to some new stuff. I mean, I will say that my tastes seem to align more with Bon than with yourself, but that hasn't stopped us being friends.
There was that terrible evening where I played you some Skronk.
What is that, a band or a style?
No, it's a thing. Yeah, Skronk.
Skronk, is it like Krunk?
I like the idea of them being Skronk, Krunk. Crossover. You could probably Skronk is that style of terrible freeform jazz noise that you also get on things like Captain Beefheart, where a saxophone goes. That's a clarinet noise, isn't it? Really,
pretty much.
You know, that kind of skronk.
Because I actually saw live. I can't remember how the goddamn thing. Blunt, not blunt. Bonk.
He blurted out.
Who have been around for a long time, and it's actually basically one guy and a guy on a laptop. But the one guy, Mr. Milton, can't remember his first name, in fact, the father of a friend of mine. Hello, Maud, if you're listening. We saw him live. He was actually supporting, but it was him on a saxophone going... but then kind of doing sort of freeform poetry interlaced with bursts of raw noise from the laptop, and that was quite an interesting...
Well, are they a British album?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're from Bristol?
Possibly.
I think you may well have been on a compilation I've got, which also includes Glaxo Babies. It was very, very kind of creative, sort of open-ended musical scene in Bristol, post-punk.
I think what he does has changed very dramatically over the years. But
well, that element of skronk is why I thought that might be the same blurt. I was just about to check on my iPhone.
What kind of things do Bon and you cover? Well, are you, for example, are you on the Pop Pulse?
No, we're never knowingly on the Pop Pulse. Although, actually, I often think that there's a bit of a discussion to be had there. Uh-huh. Because we are driven a little bit by wanting to seem faintly relevant. I mean, we don't have to do this. And that means that we have to choose to review certain things. We get sent a lot of stuff electronically every now and again. We get some hard copies, we get some dead media stuff.
Yeah.
But we have to choose to do something, and that usually means that we have to pick that over other stuff. And one of the criteria I think we are still using is that it's relatively current.
Okay.
I used to do a sort of Whatever Happened to Them, obscure stuff from the past, which we don't do so much now, and I think it's because we do feel that we have to.
You've got to say that.
Yeah. Bon always denies this, but usually he's doing quite obscure things that have only recently come out. So we're not doing. There's some really good music blogs out there. Some very good sites that are more like proper music papers now, like The Quietus and
Looking at your links.
Yeah,
column on the website. So I was like, my God, this. I'm glad that I've found both Bars On to have stuff on there that I like, because even though it's opened my ears to some new stuff, I don't think I'm ready to really dive back into this whole universe of music that I just don't know about.
The thing about blogs is that they are clearly quite personal things when you've only got two people on them. But something like The Quietus is more like a paper, because they've got a small but quite dedicated team. And they don't just churn stuff. It's not churnalism.
Okay.
They don't just...
Do they do listicles?
What's a listicle?
It's an article that's basically a list.
No, like The Enemy, for example. The Enemy is terrible for that. The Enemy online now is essentially just
BuzzFeed about music.
Yeah.
I mean, BuzzFeed are great, because if you ever want to see 40 pictures of cats sitting on things.
Yeah, but those things will end up on the slightly crappier social media like Facebook eventually. Yeah. They'll just be sifted.
It's sifted.
I crowdsource them, and my friends pick ones that they think I'll like. That's effectively how Facebook works, isn't it?
Yes.
In the same way Twitter does, but Twitter's more kind of open-ended, I guess.
Yeah.
But the thing, so something like The Quietus is good because they have an opinion, The Line of Best Fit too, and there's some other good sites. So if you want to keep up with music but get some kind of opinion, they're a good option.
Right.
I think you probably like what we do, because you do like the kinds of music Bon likes, and every now and again some of the stuff I like.
Yes, every now and again it has
happened. Because you know it already.
Yes, and I suppose when it's a blog, I mean, okay, Both Bars On is a thing in its own right, but it's basically two guys.
Yeah.
Which means it is just the taste of two guys.
Yeah.
Whereas The Quietus, or The Enemy, or God forbid, Pitchfork, it's Pitchfork, and they are the arbiters, and da-da-da-da. And so you don't really know who is writing unless you start caring a lot and picking out names. Yeah. You go, I like the stuff that this guy's like. You want to be able to easily focus on a person and say, well, oh, good, if he likes it, I'm likely to like it as well. And in fact, I talked about this stuff with one of my previous guests, Tom Murphy, in San Francisco, who we talked about how the fact that the democratisation of distribution of music means that there's so much to listen to that how are you supposed to find it? And the percentage of crap is just as big.
I think it's higher. I think there's more crap. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that more people can make a record in their bedrooms and email it to the editors of a music blog.
Yeah.
You haven't been able to do that in those numbers before. But I do think that a larger proportion of that music is probably only really meant for the parents of that person, and possibly their current boyfriend or girlfriend. And it's not really... I don't think the expansion of the ability to make music has actually helped very much. Not that I'm suggesting we go back to the bad old days.
No.
But I think there's a lot of crap music out there, and it's harder and harder to sort of, you know...
Which is why it's all the more important to have, not gatekeepers necessarily, but no. Cartographers.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Thank you.
Geography.
Yeah, so. I mean, I don't know about Bon, although I think he spends a lot more time online keeping up with stuff than I do.
Right.
So he's getting...
Plus he has to read about, you know, jazz and who
in between the jazz magazines. Yeah, he'll be reading... he'll be reading Wired. I love you, Bon, I really do. So he does. He picks up some of his ideas clearly from other people who he trusts. I think there's a kind of network of trust and opinion. He will qualify some of his opinions because he knows that, you know. But I just tend to still go on the idea that I hear something and I like it. And sometimes I'll blog about it, even if I know it's been around for ages. It's just that I think I have to tell people I like it. I don't know why. When I started doing this on a platform that's no longer out there, as hipsters all around the world are now saying, "Yeah, I reviewed that when it was out on Yahoo 360."
Yeah. It
was a platform I did use for my first ever blog post.
Oh.
It was kind of, I didn't really know if anyone was reading it. It was actually quite nice just to write about music without knowing who was going to get it. And now, of course, we have a really good sense of who's reading it, because you can see the territories in which people are listening, and you can check his stats and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
You can see how much of it comes from aggregators and, you know, how much it comes via Facebook and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's actually a bit less... It was more relaxing when you just threw it out into the void and literally nobody heard it or listened to it or whatever. Partly because it meant you didn't get into problems with copyright.
Right.
Which we now avoid, of course, by only ever putting stuff up on SoundCloud or YouTube or whatever. But
yeah, and let them deal with it.
Yeah, I did have one cease and desist order.
Okay, what was that about?
Crystal Castles, who, you know, I quite like them. And I put up a 1.5 minute... long song, which was basically the right length for a mobile phone ringtone.
Is that why they wanted you to do
that?
No,
I just think they were employing some poor, you know, intern to
track stuff down.
Send non-threatening, passive-aggressive emails. We took it down immediately, but it was about the only time we've ever had any trouble.
Small confession. After we did the... Mrs. Freshley's Dreamies review, I did say I wasn't going to eat the other one. However, after Robin went to bed and I was clearing up, I ate the other one in 3 bites, washed down with cold milk, and it was delicious. Just wanted to get that off my chest. Thank you. Bond covers the jazz angle. What do you cover?
There is some overlap. So I... Occasionally, I think probably...
Sorry, there's a mobile app.
There is some overlap.
Overlap, sorry.
Sorry,
so there's a mobile app. I thought you said there were both bars on mobile app.
No, there should
app.
Be, but we don't know anyone who's good enough at programming to write something.
Don't look at
what
me.
Would it look like, anyway? No, there is some overlap in our musical tastes.
Yes.
And the stuff that we overlap on is what we call cloak rock. That's the genre that we think we named. Although it was there before that, obviously, Hawkwind, Sever, Bar...
Yes.
But all the stuff which is, it's quite a broad bag of things, but everything from the kind of Hacks and Cloak sort of sound stuff, which is very doomy and sounds like a Skyrim soundtrack, basically.
Okay.
Through to groups like Teeth of the Sea, which are more kind of a cross between a kind of electronic and rocky. They do, you know, they have played the Flash Gordon soundtrack in its entirety in the past, so they've got that kind of
my favourite
mixture.
Track from the Flash Gordon soundtrack is, of course, the Battle scene,
which they've covered on one of their EPs,
which has a fantastic drum lead in, and then
that's superb live. I mean, they're an amazing band. They really should be bigger, and I think they're probably not bigger because they are slightly threatening to look at. They're nice guys, I'm sure, but you know, they seem slightly kind of genuinely peculiar. Yes. Although they just moved into a more electronic kind of direction as well.
Okay.
But there's a whole range of stuff out there, and they take their cue from everything from sort of John Carpenter or Goblin-style horror soundtrack stuff.
Right.
Through to some, you know, the more diseased bits of poodle metal.
Poodle metal, as in hair metal, buffonted.
Yeah.
yeah,
high energy. You know, it's some of the least appealing genres all mixed together, but sounding brilliant.
That's good.
That's the best way of putting it. And people like Nod as well, who are from Salford. There's a
big Gnod,
sort of,
yes.
Yeah, I never know whether you pronounce it.
Well, I'm just done, I'm for the benefit of
course,
the listener.
Yes. they are part of this kind of collective of people who do that kind of thing.
Mm.
And there's a festival now that gets all these bands together every now and again. Yeah, and of course, there's Goat, the Swedish band. You know,
okay,
Goat.
No,
that was our album of the year last year, Matt. Weren't you looking at our Christmas roundup?
I was. In fact, I originally wanted to have a quick interview with you both sometime, where
ahead
you could have your pop picking sort of rundown of the best of the year.
Yes, but that didn't happen.
Well, you know, it could still maybe middle of the year or something.
Yeah.
Put some snippets together. Maybe you could just record something and send it to me.
Well, yeah, that would be good. It takes us 2 months to get the Christmas special lined up. If we had to do a 6-monthly one, we better start now, I think.
That's great. Thank you very much for your time, James.
Thank you.
We've covered all sorts of wonderful stuff. I would love to be able to carry on and talk about lots more stuff, but sadly you have some students coming who need
just the one
to what are you going to be doing with your student?
He's got his PhD viva in 2 weeks and he's coming to not practice the viva, but talk about what he might be asked and run through some ideas and...
Well, you're a great sponsor or whatever you're called, the PhD
supervisor.
I know someone who's having terrible trouble with hers, so I'm glad to know that you're...
Well, my heart goes out to them both, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's not the supervisor. I mean, it's not the student's fault.
It really isn't.
I've been on both sides of that.
I can't say any more, but it really isn't the student in this case.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, James. Fantastic to talk to you.
Thank you.
And speak to you soon.
Goodbye.
The Coiled Spring was created, edited and presented by Matthew Petty and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. Music is by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com and you can send suggestions, comments, requests and demands to feedback@coiledspring.org. Thanks for listening.